Chapter 5. The Senior Counselor Falku gave a dinner party. During most of it, he wished sincerely that he had not given a dinner party. It was to be a party in the old style, the old world style, with five courses and fine clothes and conversation and music after dinner. The old men arrived at the hour, each accompanied by his wife and an unmarried daughter or two. Some of the younger men, such as young Helder, also arrived on time with their wives. The women stood about the fireplace at one end of the hall of Casa Falku in their long gowns and jewelry and chattered. The men stood about the fireplace at the other end of the hall in their best black suits and talked. All seemed to be going well, just as it had gone when Counselor Falku's grandfather, Don Ramon, had given dinner parties, just like dinner parties back on Earth, as Don Ramon had often said with satisfaction and conviction, for after all, his father, Don Luis, had been born on Earth and had been the greatest man in Rio de Janeiro. But some of the guests had not come on time. It got later, and still they did not come. Counselor Falku was summoned by his daughter to the kitchen. The cooks' faces were tragic. The superb dinner would be ruined. At his command, the long table was carried into the hall and set. The guests sat down. The first course was served, eaten, cleared away. The second course was served, and then, only then, in came young Macmillan, young Marquess, young Wyler, free and easy, without an apology and, what was worse, with a whole rabble of their friends, uninvited. Seven or eight big bucks with whips in their belts and broad-brimmed hats, which they didn't know enough to take off indoors, and dirty boots, and a whole lot of loud, dirty talk. New places had to be set, crowded in among the others. The young men had been drinking before they came, and went on swilling Falku's best ale. They pinched the maidservants, but ignored the ladies. They shouted across the table and blew their noses in the embroidered napkins. When the supreme moment of the dinner arrived, the meat course, roast coney, Falku had hired 10 trappers for a week to supply this luxury. The latecomers piled their plates so greedily that there was not enough to go round, and no one at the foot of the table got meat. The same thing happened with the dessert, a molded pudding made with root starch, boiled fruits, and nectar. Several of the young men scooped it out of the bowls with their fingers. Falku signaled his daughter at the foot of the table, and she led a retreat of the ladies to the garden sitting room at the back of the house. This left the young toughs all the more freedom to lounge, spit, belch, swear, and get drunker. Small cups of the brandy for which the still rooms of Casa Falku were famous got tossed off like water, and the young men yelled at the bewildered servants to refill. Some of the other young men, and some of the older ones, liked this crude behavior, or perhaps thought it was how one was expected to behave at a dinner party, and joined in it. Old Helder got so drunk he went and vomited in the corner, but he came back to table and started drinking again. Falku and some close friends, the elder Marquess, Bunier, and the doctor, withdrew to the hearth and tried to talk, but the noise around the long table was deafening. Some were dancing, some quarreling. The musicians hired to play after dinner had mixed in with the guests and were drinking like fish. Young Marquess had a serving girl on his lap, where she sat white-faced and cringing, muttering, "Oh, Jesus Maria! Oh, Jesus Maria!" "A very merry party, Luis," old Bournier said, after a particularly painful outburst of song and screeching. Falku had remained calm throughout. His face was calm as he replied, "A proof of our degeneration." "The young fellows aren't used to such feasts. Only Casa Falku knows how to give a party in the old style, the real earth style." "They are degenerates," Falku said. His brother-in-law, Cooper, a man of 60, nodded. "We have lost the style of Earth."
"Not at all,"
said a man behind them. They all turned. It was Herman Macmillan, one of the latecomers. He had been guzzling and shouting with the rest, but showed no signs of drunkenness now, except perhaps the heightened color of his handsome young face. "It seems to me, gentlemen, that we're rediscovering this style of Earth. After all, who were our ancestors that came from the old world? Not weak, meek men, were they? Brave men, bold, strong men who knew how to live. Now we're learning again how to live. Plans, laws, rules, manners. What's that got to do with us? Are we slaves? Women? What are we afraid of? We're men, free men, masters of a whole world. It's time we came into our inheritance. That's how it is, gentlemen." He smiled, deferential yet perfectly self-confident. Falku was impressed. Perhaps this wreck of a dinner party might serve some purpose after all. This young Macmillan, who had never seemed anything but a fine, muscular animal, a likely future match for Luge Marina, was showing both willpower and brains, the makings of a man.
"I agree with you, Don Herman," he said. "But I'm able to agree with you only because you and I are still able to talk, unlike most of our friends there. A man must be able to drink and think. Since only you of the young men seem able to do both, tell me, what do you think of my idea of making Latifundia?"
"Big farms, that means?"
"Yes, big farms. Large fields planted in one crop for efficiency. My idea is to pick managers from among our best young men, to give each a large region to run, an estate, and enough peasants to work it, and let him run it as he wishes. Thus, more food will be produced. The excess population in Shantytown will be put to work and kept under control to prevent any more talk about independence and new colonies, and the next generation of city men will include a number of great estate owners. We've kept close together for strength long enough. It's time, as you said, that we spread out, use our freedom, make ourselves masters of this rich world of ours."
Herman Macmillan listened, smiling. His finely cut lips had an almost constant smile.
"Not a bad idea," he said. "Not a bad idea at all, Senior Counselor."
Falku bore with his patronizing tone because he had decided that Herman Macmillan was a man he could make use of.
"Consider it," he said. "Consider it for yourself." He knew young Macmillan was doing just that. "How would you like to own such an estate, Don Herman? A little, what's the word? An old word?"
"Kingdom,"
old Bernier supplied.
"Yes, a little kingdom for yourself. How does it strike you?"
He spoke flatteringly, and Herman Macmillan preened himself. In the self-important, Falku reflected, there is always room for a little more self-importance.
"Not bad," Macmillan said, nodding judiciously. "To carry out the plan, we'll need the vigor of you young men and the brains. Opening up new farmland has always been a slow business. Forced labor is the only way to clear large areas quickly. If this unrest in Shantytown goes on, we can have plenty of peasant rebels to sentence to forced labor. But since they're all words and no actions, they may have to be pushed. We may have to crack the whip to make them fight. We may have to drive them to rebellion, you understand? How does that kind of action strike you?"
"A pleasure, senor. Life's boring here. Action is what we want."
"Action," Falku thought, "is also what I want. I should like to knock this condescending young man's teeth out, but he is going to be useful, and I shall use him." And smile.
"That's what I hoped to hear. Listen, Don Herman, you have influence among the young men, a natural gift of leadership. Now tell me what you think of this. Our regular guards are loyal enough, but they're commoners, stupid men, easily confused by the shantytowners' tricks. What we need to lead them is a troop of elite soldiers, young aristocrats,
brave, intelligent, and properly commanded. Men who love fighting, like our brave ancestors of Earth. Do you think such a troop could be brought together and trained? How would you suggest we go about it? All you need is a leader, Herman Macmillan said without hesitation. I could train up a group like that in a week or two. After that night, young Macmillan became a frequent visitor at Casa Falku, coming in at least once a day to talk with the counselor. Whenever Luge was in the front part of the house, it seemed Macmillan was there, and she took to spending more and more time in her own room, or the attic, or the garden sitting room. She had always avoided Herman Macmillan, not because she disliked him. It was impossible to dislike anyone so handsome, but because it was humiliating to know that everybody, seeing Luge and Herman say a word to each other, was thinking and saying, "Ah, they'll be married soon." Whether he wanted to or not, he brought the idea of marriage with him, constraining her, too, to think about it. And not wanting to think about it, she had always been very shy with him. Nowadays it was the same, except that, seeing him daily as a familiar of the house, she had decided that, although it was wasteful and a pity, you could dislike even a very handsome man. He came into the back sitting room without knocking at the door and stood in the doorway, a graceful and powerful figure in his tightly belted tunic. He surveyed the room, which faced inward on the large central garden around which the back part of the house was built. The garden doors stood open, and the sound of fine, mild rain falling on the paths and shrubs of the garden filled the room with quietness. "So this is where you hide away," he said. Luge had risen when he appeared. She wore a dark homespun skirt and a white shirt that glimmered in the dim light. Behind her in the shadows, another woman sat spinning with a drop spindle. "Always hiding away here, eh?" Herman repeated. He came no farther into the room, perhaps waiting to be invited in, perhaps also conscious of his dramatic presence framed in the doorway.
"Good afternoon, Don Herman. Are you looking for my father?"
"I've just been talking to him,"
Luge nodded. Though she was curious to know what Herman and her father talked about so much lately, she certainly wasn't going to ask. The young man came on into the room and stood in front of Luge, looking at her with his good-humored smile. He reached out and took her hand, raised it to his lips, and kissed it. Luge pulled away in a spasm of annoyance.
"That is a stupid custom," she said, turning away.
"All customs are stupid, but the old folks can't get on without them, eh? They think the world would fall apart. Hand-kissing, bowing, senor this and senora that, how it was done on the old world, history, books, rubbish."
"Well,"
Luge laughed in spite of herself. It was fine to hear Herman simply brush away as nonsense the things that loomed so large and worrisome in her life.
"The Black Guards are coming on very well," he said. "You must come see us train. Come tomorrow morning."
"What Black Guards?" she asked disdainfully, sitting down and taking up her work, a bit of fine sewing for Eva's expected fourth child. That was the trouble with Herman. If you once smiled or said something natural or felt like admiring him, he pushed in, pushed his advantage, and you had to snub him at once.
"My little army," he replied.
"What's that?"
He sat down beside her on the wicker settee. There was not enough room for his big body and her slight one. She tugged her skirt out from under his thigh.
"A bonnet," she said, trying to control her temper, which was rising. "For Evita's baby."
"Oh, God, yes, what a breeder that girl is. Aldo has his quiver full. We don't take married men in the guards. A fine bunch they are. You have to come see them."
Luge made a microscopic embroidery knot, and no reply.
"I've been out looking over my land. That's why I wasn't here yesterday."
"I didn't notice," said Luge.
"Choosing my property. A valley down on Mill River. Fine country, that is, once it's cleared. My house will be built up on a hill.
I saw the site for it at once. A big house, like this one, but bigger. Two stories, with porches all round, and barns and a smithy and so on. Then, down in the valley near the river, the peasants' huts where I can look down on them. Bog rice in the marshes where the river spreads out in the valley bottom. Orchards on the hillsides, tree silk and fruit. I'll lumber some of the forests and save some for coney hunting. A beautiful place, it'll be a kingdom. Come and see it with me next time I go down there. I'll send the pedicab from Casa Macmillan. It's too far for a girl to walk. You should see it.
What for?
You'll like it, Herman said with absolute confidence. How would you like to have a place like that yourself? Own everything in sight. A big house, lots of servants, your own kingdom.
Women aren't kings, Luge said.
She bent her head over a stitch. The light was really too dim now for sewing, but it gave her the excuse not to look at Herman. He kept looking at her, staring, his face intent and expressionless. His eyes seemed darker than usual, and he had stopped smiling. But all at once his mouth opened and he laughed. A small laugh for so big a man.
No. All the same, women have a way of getting what they want, don't they, my little Luge?
She sewed on and did not answer. Herman put his face close to hers and whispered, "Get rid of the old woman."
"What did you say?"
Luge inquired in a normal speaking voice. "Get rid of her," Herman repeated with a slight nod. Luge stuck her needle carefully into its case, folded her sewing, and stood up.
"Excuse me, Don Herman. I must go speak to the cook," she said, and went out.
The other woman sat still, spinning. Herman sat for a minute, sucking his lips. He smiled, got up, and sauntered out, his thumbs in his belt. After a quarter hour, Luge looked in the doorway by which she had left, and seeing no Herman Macmillan, came back in.
"That clod," she said, and spat on the floor.
"He's very good-looking," said Vera,
teasing out a last shred of tree silk, twirling it into a fine, even thread, and bringing the full spindle back to her lap.
"Very," said Luge.
She picked up the neatly folded baby bonnet on which she had been working, looked at it, squashed it into a ball, and threw it across the room.
"Screw," she said.
"The way he talked to you makes you angry," Vera said, half questioningly.
"The way he talks, the way he looks, the way he sits, the way he is. Ugh! My little army, my big house, my servants, my peasants, my little Luge. If I were a man, I'd knock his head on the wall till his big teeth fell out."
Vera laughed. She did not laugh often, usually only when she was startled.
"No, you wouldn't."
"I would. I'd kill him."
"Oh, no. No. You wouldn't. Because if you were a man, you'd know you were as strong as he, or stronger, and so you wouldn't have to prove it. The trouble is, being a woman, here, where they always tell you you're weak, you believe them. That was funny when he said the South Valleys are too far for a girl to walk, about 12 kilometers. I've never walked that far. Probably not half that far."
"Well, that's what I mean. They tell you you're weak and helpless, and if you believe it, you get mad and want to hurt people."
"Yes, I do," Luge said, facing around to Vera. "I want to hurt people. I want to, and I probably will."
Vera sat still, looking up at the girl.
"Yes,"
she spoke more gravely. "If you marry a man like that and live his life, then I agree. You may not really want to hurt people, but you will." Luge stared back at her.
"That is hateful," she said at last. "Hateful to say it that way. That I haven't any choice, that I have to hurt people, that it doesn't even matter what I want."
"Of course it matters what you want."
"It doesn't. That's the whole point."
"It does.
And that's the whole point. You choose. You choose whether or not to make choices.
Lou stood there a minute longer, still staring at her. Her cheeks were still burning red with temper, but her eyebrows were not drawn down level. They were raised as if in surprise or fright, as if something altogether unexpected had risen up before her. She moved indecisively, then went out the open door into the garden that lay at the heart of the house. The touch of the sparse rain on her face was gentle. Raindrops falling into the little fountain basin in the center of the garden made delicate interlocking rings, each ring gone in an instant of urgent outward motion, a ceaseless tremor of clear, fleeting circles on the surface of the water in the round basin of gray stone. House walls and shuttered windows stood all round the garden, silent. The garden was like an inner room of the house, shut in, protected. But a room with the roof taken off. A room into which rain fell. Luge's arms were wet and cold. She shuddered. She returned to the door, the dim room where Vera sat. She stood between Vera and the light and said in a rough, low voice, "What kind of man is my father?" There was a pause. "Is it fair of you to ask me that? Or of me to answer?" "Well, I suppose so. So, what can I say? He's strong. He's a king. A real one. It's just a word. I don't know what it means. We have old stories. The king's son who rode on the tiger. Well, I mean he's strong of soul. He has grandeur of heart. But when a man is shut up inside walls that he's been building stronger and higher all his life, then maybe no strength is enough. He can't get out." Luge crossed the room, stooped to pick up the baby bonnet she had flung under a chair, and stood with her face turned from Vera, smoothing out the little scrap of half-embroidered cloth.
"Neither can I," she said.
"Oh, no, no," the older woman said energetically. "You're not inside the walls with him. He doesn't protect you. You protect him. When the wind blows, it doesn't blow on him, but on the roof and walls of this city that his father's built as a fortress against the unknown, a protection. And you're part of that city, part of his roofs and walls, his house, Casa Falcu. So is his title, Señor, Counselor, Boss. So are all his servants and his guards, all the men and women he can give orders to. They're all part of his house, the walls to keep the wind off him. Do you see what I mean? I say it so foolishly, I don't know how to say it. What I mean is, I think your father is a man who should be a great man, but he's made a bad mistake. He has never come outside into the rain." Vera began to wind the thread she had spun off the spindle into a skein, peering at it in the dim light. "And so, because he won't let himself be hurt, he does wrong to those he loves best. And then he sees that, and after all, it hurts him."
"Hurts him?" the girl said fiercely.
"Oh, that's the last thing we learn about our parents. The last thing, because after we learn it, they aren't our parents any longer, but just other people like us." Luge sat down on the wicker settee and put the baby bonnet on her knee, continuing to smooth it out carefully with two fingers. After quite a while, she said, "I'm glad you came here, Vera." Vera smiled and went on winding off the thread. "I'll help with that." On her knees, feeding the thread off the spindle so that Vera could wind it in even loops, she said, "It was stupid of me to say that. You want to go back to your family. You're in jail here." "A very pleasant jail. And I have no family. Of course I want to go back, to come and go as I like." "You never marry?" "There was so much else to do," Vera said, smiling and placid.
So much else to do. There's nothing else to do for us.
No?
If you don't marry, you're an old maid. You make bonnets for other women's babies. You order the cook to make fish soup. You get laughed at.
Are you afraid of that, being laughed at?
Yes. Very much.
Lou spent some while untangling a length of thread that had snagged on the shank of the spindle.
I don't care if stupid people laugh, she said more quietly. But I don't like to be scorned.
And the scorn would be deserved.
Because it takes courage to really be a woman, just as much as to be a man. It takes courage to really be married and to bear children and to bring them up.
Vera watched her face.
Yes, it does. Great courage. But again, is that your only choice? Marriage and motherhood, or nothing?
What else is there for a woman?
What else that really counts?
Vera turned a little to look out the open doors into the gray garden. She sighed, a deep, involuntary drawing of breath.
I wanted a child very much, she said. But you see, there were other things that counted.
She smiled faintly.
Oh, yes, it's a choice, but not the only one. One can be a mother and a great deal else besides. One can do more than one thing, with the will and the luck.
My luck wasn't good, or maybe I was wrong-headed, made the wrong choice. I don't like compromise, you see. I set my heart on a man who had his heart set on somebody else. That was Sasha. Alexander Schultz, Lev's father.
Oh, a long, long time ago, before you were born. So he married, and I went on with the work I was good at, because it always interested me, but there weren't any other men who did. But even if I'd married, did I have to sit in the back room all my life? You know, if we sit in the back room, with babies or without babies, and leave all the rest of the world to the men, then of course the men will do everything and be everything. Why should they? They're only half the human race. It's not fair to leave them all the work to do, not fair to them or us. Besides, and she smiled more broadly, I like men very much, but sometimes they're so stupid, so stuffed with theories. They go in straight lines only and won't stop. It's dangerous to do that. It's dangerous to leave everything up to the men, you know. That's one reason why I'd like to go home, at least for a visit, to see what Eliah with his theories and my dear young Lev with his ideals are up to. I get worried they'll go too fast and too straight and get us into a place we can't get out of. A trap. You see, it seems to me that where men are weak and dangerous is in their vanity. A woman has a center. Is a center, but a man isn't. He's a reaching out. So he reaches out and grabs things and piles them up around him and says, I'm this, I'm that, this is me, that's me, I'll prove that I am me. And he can wreck a lot of things trying to prove it. That's what I was trying to say about your father. If he'd only be Luis Falcu, that is quite enough. But no, he has to be the boss, the counselor, the father, and so on. What a waste. And Lev, he's terribly vain, too, maybe in the same way. A great heart, but not sure where the center is. Oh, I wish I could talk with him just for 10 minutes and make sure.
Vera had long since forgotten to wind her thread. She shook her head sadly and looked down at the skein with a faraway gaze.
Go on, then, Luge said in a low voice.
Vera looked mildly puzzled.
Go back to the town. Tonight. I'll let you out. And I'll tell my father tomorrow that I did so. I can do something. Something besides sit here and sew and swear and listen to that stupid Macmillan. Lithe, robust, and commanding, the girl had leapt to her feet and stood over Vera, who sat still, looking shrunken.
I've given my word, Luz Marina.
What does that matter? If I don't speak truth, I can't seek truth, Vera answered in a hard voice. They stared at each other, their faces set. I have no child, Vera said, and you have no mother. If I could help you, child, I would. But not that way. I keep my promises. I make no promises, Luge said. She cleared a strand of thread from the spindle. Vera wound it onto the skein.